Hi, welcome to another episode of the Biographics Podcast. I am your host, Simon Whistler, and last time we brought you Hugh Hefner, which was a nice break from the kind of miserable few people we'd done through in the previous episodes. But don't worry, today the misery's back, because we're covering Hermann Göring. You might know him as a Nazi. Originally, though, he was kind of a hero. Not something you'd associate with him today, for sure, but in World War I, his actions were kind of different. In fact, he was one of the most famous combat pilots in all of Germany. He was a national hero. But just 30 years later, just three short decades later, he had entirely trashed his reputation, as you probably know. He died with the blood of millions of people on his hands, and basically everyone, when they hear the name Göring today, they think of monster rather than World War I hero, sort of like maybe the Red Baron is remembered. Not really a hero, but like a folklore figure who is not just remembered as being a monster. So, in the episode today, we're exploring both the soaring highs, literally, as a heroic pilot, and the horribly crashing lows of Hermann Göring. We're getting in, and those lows are dark. Like, I didn't know this, but he had some pretty horrific drug addictions and stuff like that, and definitely some very real struggles. So let's dive into his life, but let's, as we always do, let's start out where he was born, or how he was born, what he was born into. He kind of had this ironic privileged start. Now, he wasn't kind of privileged in the traditional sense. His parents didn't have very much money, but they did know someone who did. And indeed, he was made Göring's godfather. He was a very wealthy man. He had castles, and indeed the Göring family weren't so well off. In fact, his godfather invited the entire Göring family to live at one of those castles. Particularly notable here, given what we know about the future of Göring's life, this man was Jewish. Another notable thing was that he was having an affair with Göring's mother, and you might think, okay, maybe this is why he really didn't like the Jews, but no, it seems really from everything we know Hermann Göring at the beginning, he didn't really seem to mind, and he and his godfather were very close. In fact, they went on various adventures together. They often went hunting and climbing and manly activities like that, so they actually seemed to be very close. Indeed, as Hermann got older, he wasn't really sure what he wanted to do. Eventually, he was kind of like, oh, I think I'm going to get into the military. And he got into that from a really young age. Indeed, his godfather even pulled strings for him. He got him into a very prestigious military academy. And this military experience, it leads to, of course, as you probably know, World War I. That broke out in 1914. Göring at this point was 21 years old, so he was prime military age. And he started, as you know, many people do, in the infantry. And he was keen to get glory. He was into war. He was into the military from a young age, and he really wanted to kind of crack on and make a name for himself. However, he kind of thought after a while that maybe the infantry wasn't the best place to do this. Pilots, combat pilots, kind of a new thing. The Imperial German Flying Corps was what you could join at the time. So he was like, I'm getting out of the infantry. I'm going to get into this Imperial German Flying Corps. And he does. And indeed, when he's a member of it, he quickly rises through the ranks and he becomes a combat pilot. And He was pretty good at this. In fact, all those hunting trips he'd taken with his Jewish godfather had made him an excellent marksman, and apparently this transferred rather well to the skies. He was notable. Like I said, he got promoted real fast and became a pilot real fast. So basically, less than a year after the war started, bear in mind he'd already been in the infantry, he was already flying. And within his first month in the skies, he got his first kill, and within the next year, he racked up three more. Now, he was first shot down in 1916, but that was actually the only time during the entire war that he was shot down. And you might be thinking, oh, well, that's not special. Is being a pilot really that dangerous in the war? Oh, yes, it absolutely was. In fact, it was probably more dangerous than you can even imagine. There's kind of a lot of different estimates about how long pilots would live and kind of whether that was time in the air or kind of months on the ground or like how often are you flying. But basically, at one point, there was this group of pilots and they created something called the 20-minute club, because that was the estimated lifespan of a pilot while flying in the First World War from the years 1916 to 1917. So it was insanely dangerous. The fact that Goering only got shot down one time is a testament to pretty incredible piloting skills. It did keep him out of action for a while, though. That getting shot down in 1916, he was off to the hospital. He had to recover for a long time. But when he did get back in that pilot seat, he came back with absolute vengeance and just started racking up the kills like crazy. He very quickly became an ace pilot. He got a bunch of rewards. And also, kind of, like I said at the beginning, he was a bit of a hero at this point. He started becoming pretty famous. Magazines were writing articles about him, his face was printed on a bunch of German matchboxes, and Goering, he was really into it. He wasn't like a modest guy, as we will definitely see later. He was very, very far from modest, and he was reveling in the attention and the glory and all of this stuff. And now, this is where I mentioned the Red Baron earlier. He's around at the same time. You've probably heard of him, maybe if it's just in those Snoopy cartoons. But anyway, the Red Baron, he enters the picture at this point in our story, and he very quickly exits the picture because he is killed. He's shot down. By the way, his real name, Manfred Ron von Richthofen. I actually made a video about him on one of my YouTube channels. Today I found out, I'm sure if you punch into Google Today I Found Out Red Baron, or YouTube more accurately, you will find that. So if you want to learn more about Manfred von Richthofen, go check him out. I did a video about him on the Today I Found Out channel. If you're interested in it, maybe you should do a biographics video about him or a biographics podcast. Drop me an email, simon@biographics.org, and we'll see what we can do. If you're into that, just let me know. Anyway, Red Baron, as you probably know, he was one of the most elite German fighter pilots. And after his death, there was this big question of, who are we going to get to replace him? Who's going to take the, you know, that prestigious seat as the Red Baron held? He was the leader of a fighter squadron. Now, to the surprise of many, Goering was chosen over a whole bunch of candidates. Candidates which people thought were kind of better skilled. One of those candidates was actually the Red Baron's own brother. You know, Goering was an ace. He was a very, very, very good pilot, but there were probably better options. However, German military brass, they saw something in him that maybe these other guys didn't have. He wasn't just a great pilot, but he was very charming. He was a good officer, he was a natural leader. So all of these things, they kind of came together, and he was put in charge of the elite squad that von Richthofen, the Red Baron, had previously run. So everything's going rather well for Goering. He's in charge of this elite squad, he's getting famous, everything, and he loves it all. Everything's gravy. But not everything is gravy for Germany. You know, as we all know, they did lose the First World War, and this is a very hard time for Germany. The war at this point, as he's put in charge of this unit, it's definitely taking a turn. Germany's just not able to keep up with the production of aircraft that the French and the British are making. They're just absolutely outproducing the Germans, and that's a big problem. Germany can't keep up. Superior firepower from the British and the French. The war is turning. And then another pretty major factor, the USA had just declared war on Germany. Indeed, the last offensive from Germany failed, and they sued for peace. And as you might know, that was on the 11th of November, 1918. Very close to 100 years later, we're making this video. I think, we're about a month off. I'm recording this in early December. So, yeah, 100 years ago. End of the war comes, and Goering, delivers a tearful address to his men who are stationed at a French airfield, and rather ominously, considering what we know about Goering's for the rest of his life, he states, "Our time will come again." And that was the last time I will attempt a German accent in this podcast, I promise. Okay, so the war's over, but he's still famous. You know, he's on those matchboxes, he's written up in magazines, he's still pretty notable. Anyway, he needs a job, he's got to do something, and he's like, I'm going to put my piloting skills to use. But he doesn't just go and become like a commercial pilot, kind of not so much demand for that back in the day. He starts doing acrobatics, aerial acrobatics, and people were pretty impressed with these. But, you know, as people tend to be with pretty much everything, after a while people got bored of it. So, yeah, kind of think this is the way things go. No matter how good something is, eventually everyone sees it or gets tired of it, or other people come along and do it better. And at this point, he basically is like, okay, I'll just take a normal pilot job. So he starts flying charter flights. And this isn't such a bad thing for him. At the time he's being a pilot, he meets his future wife. She was a woman. She was a countess, actually. She was called Karen von Foch, and they immediately fell in love. One slight snag, though. She was definitely married, and she definitely had children. In 1922, she leaves her husband, and she leaves her a child, and she decides to try to take a new life with Goering. Like I said, very charming was Goering. Anyway, so now enter not a man who's quickly going to exit the picture, like the Red Baron did, but rather a man who's going to stick around, and I bet you can guess who that man might be. It was Adolf Hitler. Okay, now, at this point, Adolf Hitler is not the figure that we remember. He was kind of a nobody, just a non-important troublemaker causing a bit of strife as an Austrian for the German government. Now, Karen, however, Goering's wife, she absolutely saw something in him. She was like, essentially said to Hermann, attach yourself to this guy. He is going places. Be his friend. Get in good with him. He's up to stuff. Anyway, Goering agreed, and very, very much so. So much so that a year later, they together decided that they would try and overthrow the German government. Now, this might be a part of history, you know, like kind of Hitler's rise to power is fairly extensively documented. Movies, I studied this in school, all of this kind of stuff. Anyway, Nazi Party at this point, though, it wasn't what it came to be. But they did manage to get 2,000 people together to march on the war ministry. And as Hitler was there, Goering was standing right by his side, ready to overthrow the government and kind of install themselves as leaders. They really thought, you know, Germany was kind of a bit of a mess at this time. They thought that they could just, there'd be no opposition. They would go in, they would seize power, and that would be that. But, as you probably know, that's not how Hitler came to power, and that's not what happened. Hitler ended up fleeing, Goering got shot in the thigh, and basically, now they were wanted war criminals. So their idea to take over the German government, you could say it backfired. You could say it backfired extremely badly. So what happens now? Hitler is caught, and he is arrested. Goering manages to flee. Ironically enough here, another Jew is entering the picture. A Jewish man, treats his wounds before he crosses the border over into Austria. And this is where, you know, we've kind of seen this turn that, you know, Goering's life's been going pretty, pretty awesome. Everything's going good. It's all going great. And then, boom, his plot to overthrow the government fails. That's not going to go well, but it gets a lot worse. This is kind of Goering's first foray into major drug problems. That getting shot in the thigh, basically the wound gets infected and he gets hooked on morphine. At this point, he basically gets super fat, and him and his wife, and remember, she's a countess, so she's not exactly poor, they have to start selling all their stuff off so he can afford his morphine addiction. He seems to go a bit mad, just driven mad by addiction, I suppose. Karen fears for her life, and basically, you know, Goering really loved Karen, and he's like, okay, for you, I will get off the morphine. It's time to get off the morphine. Here, the withdrawal that he has to go through has been described as so brutal that he became suicidal. However, he emerged. 1925, he was discharged from, I don't know if they had rehab clinics or the hospital or wherever he was staying to get clean. 1925, he's off his drugs and he's back to his sharp self. It's interesting with Goering because he's very sharp when he wants to be, but when he's on drugs or he's not paying proper attention, as we'll see, things go really bad for him. Anyway, but he's been released, but he's still a wanted war criminal, remember? He tried to overthrow Germany, but good news. They actually give him amnesty for the coup, which seems really generous to me. And then after he's been given amnesty, he goes back to Germany to hang out with the man, Hitler, who has been released from prison after only 9 months. They go and hang out again. If I was Germany, I would not be so generous, and I would definitely not give Hitler only 9 months. And I probably wouldn't let them hang out together afterwards, at least not with some pretty major... maybe they were surveilling him. Who knows? Either way, it didn't work out for Germany, because we know what happened. Now, speaking of what happened, well, Hitler knew that taking Germany by force. That didn't work. The coup was a failure. So now he's like, oh, what I'll do is I'll get elected. I will take over Germany by the ballot box. Now, as you also, there's a lot we know about this one because we know so much about Hitler, but he's an amazing orator. He's very good at speaking, and this is going to be a big driving factor to getting him elected. But you might not know, Hitler was fairly bad, actually, in social settings. Like, he was an amazing speaker. He could go out and do all of these things, but he wasn't very good at mingling and, like, talking to people and being, like, a regular person. He was, like, he could get a crowd fired up. He was better in front of 1,000 people than one, essentially. But Goering, his right-hand man, was an absolute master of this. Goering was basically, you know, his wife was a countess. He'd kind of grown up in this castle with this wealthy guy. He was very used to kind of being around the elite, to the kind of whining and dining that comes with that sort of politics. And Hitler put him in this position, and Goering absolutely loved this. He was completely into it. His new role was basically entirely his cup of tea. He could do all these kind of things with Germany's elite. Setback in Goering's life, though. His wife, Karen, she had always been a bit sickly and kind of consistently unwell. Sadly, she died in 1931, and Goering was absolutely distraught. Interestingly, at this point, he buys a huge residence, and like with fields and grounds and all of this stuff, and he names it Karen Hall in her memory. Anyway, let's get back to Hitler and him taking over Germany. Now, he succeeded in this, their kind of tag team of speaking and Germany's elite and all of the other stuff that's not really important for this episode about Hitler going to power, basically led to him being elected Chancellor of Germany in 1933. And he appointed Goering as the Prussian Minister of the Interior. And he also got a really nice salary to go along with that. Also, though, that salary apparently wasn't enough for him because very quickly he got into taking a large number of bribes and essentially becoming just really damn rich, like just getting tons of money together. Some of the fun things he did with this money, he got pretty famous for designing wild and crazy uniforms with all sorts of like epaulettes and like badges and medals and things like that. He also bought lots of exotic pets, as you do. But this wasn't all superficial. Like, he didn't just have money. He also had a lot of political power. And he started infiltrating other parts of German society with his power, like getting his feelers into all of the things. And one of these was the police. And he started replacing the police chiefs with essentially people who were Nazis. So he was kind of in charge of them all. And it was at this point that he kind of started doing that classic dictator or dictatorial government move. Let's repress these people who, I was going to say subversives, but they're the people we think are subversive, the Jews and the communists in this case. And unlike a lot of Nazis at the time and definitely afterwards, who kind of distanced themselves from the killings of the Nazi regime, Goering has been quoted as saying, when he was kind of accused of killing people, you know, in order to get his own way, he essentially said, "Every bullet fired from the barrel of a police pistol is my bullet. If you call that murder, then I am a murderer. Everything has been ordered by me." And in which case, Gary, I think we have to say, like, I don't know what you're trying to get at with that quote, but no, that's definitely murder. It's like murder for hire or whatever you want to call it. But no, definitely bad. Definitely bad. Now, the real problem with the Nazi party wasn't kind of the subversives. It wasn't the Jews and the communists that were actually really causing a problem for the party. It was actually like a faction within the Nazi party itself. And this was kind of the biggest risk to the future of Nazi power. And that was from the SA. This was sort of the paramilitary branch of the Nazis. They were kind of the thugs that had been pretty useful when they were like kind of rising to power. They were led by Röhm, and now they were kind of useless and, in a way, dangerous, because if there was going to be a coup against the Nazi leadership, it would come from within the SA and definitely probably going to be led by Röhm. Now, Goering was like, "Yo, Hitler, we need to purge the SA. We basically need to get rid of them all because they are our biggest threat. If Röhm gets all uppity, he's going to come in and he's going to be in charge, and he's got the manpower. He's got the brutes." So, yeah. Then we have then the Night of the Long Knives happens, which is basically, essentially, Hrom is shot, and many of Hitler's enemies are shot, and a ton of the SA whoosh, just completely wiped out. So that threat to the Nazi leadership is completely gone, and Goering, he planned most of this. Now, this really cemented Hitler's power within the power structure here. He could really now just start focusing on building up an air force and doing what he kind of came to power to do, and that is essentially get revenge on Germany's neighbors for her treatment during World War I and the Treaty of Versailles, which basically cut off Germany's legs after World War I. Now, that Treaty of Versailles had also prevented Germany, as well as incredible financial sanctions and all of this stuff that famously led to hyperinflation in Germany. Essentially, that Treaty of Versailles also prevented Germany from building up an army and an air force and kind of any military power. It really wanted to kind of neuter Germany so that it couldn't start a war again. However, Hitler, he definitely wanted to have an army and an air force, so he said to Goering, just go build up that army. Just don't tell anyone about it. Just do it in secret. The way he did this was they had a lot of mail-carrying planes, which would zip around the country at high speeds, delivering letters. They were kind of secretly converted into fighters. As for pilots, well, they were taken from the National Airline. Still exists today, by the way. Lufthansa, probably heard of that one. And yeah, so they started recruiting commercial pilots to fly these fighter jets. And this grew pretty quickly. It grew and grew and grew. 1935 rolls around. It's time to come out of hiding. The Luftwaffe is announced to the world. Now, Hitler is pumping a ton of money into the Luftwaffe. Kind of the figures don't really matter because it's hard to translate like what the Deutschmark was at the time. And then also, like, let's just compare it to the spending of other countries. Hitler was spending 10 times the amount on his Luftwaffe as France was spending on their air force, and 4 times more than Britain. So Germany, they had more powerful planes, they had more of them, and they'd also developed a really solid plan for their use. Basically, the idea was that they wouldn't be used as a solo thing. You know, you wouldn't attack just with aircraft. This hadn't gone well in the First World War. They kind of knew this. The use of artillery was a fairly analogous thing. Like, the use of artillery without additional stuff wasn't really successful. So the idea was for the planes, they would be supporting the ground troops. Now, you might think from all of this that, you know, Goering and Hitler, they were always on the same page. They're building up this air force, they're getting ready for war. Goering, he did not want to go to war. Like, why would he? He sees his life as, it's pretty good. Germany's okay, but I'm great. I'm rich, I'm powerful, I'm mingling with Germany's elite. Basically, my job is to wine and dine powerful people and eat nice food and just kind of have a pretty chill, leisurely life. It's going pretty well, and all that political power as well. It's got to be good for him. So he's not into war. He doesn't want to do that. But bad news for Goering is pretty much bad news for everybody. He is not in charge. Hitler is in charge, and Hitler is on a mission. And that was, of course, to restore Germany's greatness after the crippling effects of World War I, to get revenge. Now, Hitler was very much of the opinion that this was, you know, Germany's victory was a foregone conclusion. Germany is the best. There's no way we can lose. Goering, though, he wasn't so sure. He was kind of like, I don't know, Adolf, this could go bad, and I don't want to be on the wrong side because we're not doing such great things. Anyway, now, Goering wasn't alone here. A lot of generals felt the same way, but it doesn't matter. Goering and all the generals, they stuck by Hitler, and 1st of September 1939, one of the most famous points in history, Germany invades Poland. And this wasn't the kind of first aggression, but it was that final, this has gone too far, World War II begins. Now, not only was Goering not really into war, he wasn't really prepared for it. They got all that equipment, they got all that air force, they got all that good stuff, they're ready to go. But Goering is not really an experienced military commander. He's got a bit of limited experience leading that squadron in World War I, but that's kind of pretty much it. He's not really an expert here. And, he was smart enough, and he was absolutely ruthless enough, that's for sure. But basically, that lack of experience was what essentially just basically led him to not being very good. That's not the only problem that he faced, though. Also, kind of this lack of experience made the whole thing incredibly stressful, and he wasn't doing very well. Also, running like an Air Force during a war is going to be pretty stressful anyway. Someone like Goering, we also know he's got a history of addiction, so you're probably going to guess what's happening now. He's going to fall back on old crutches, so how does this happen? Basically, he gets a toothache, he goes to the dentist, they prescribe him painkillers, opiate-based painkillers we can assume that he gets rather addicted to, and they make him weak. You know, we talked about how sharp Goering was when he was not on drugs and how weak he was when he was, and so now he's on drugs again and he's a military leader, and this is not going to go really well. He retreats from reality. Like, something bad happens, some bad news comes in, and he doesn't focus on how we're going to deal with this bad news and we're going to build a strategy around that. He's just like, everything's fine, drugs are great. Now, not everything went terribly. The invasion of Poland, the Luftwaffe facing Poland, the Poles kind of had very outdated machinery. It wasn't a big struggle. And then again, 1940 rolls around, and he turns his Luftwaffe on France. Again, not a particularly big deal. They were spending 10 times as much, as we know, as France. It's not going to be a terrible thing. But things change during a very famous part of World War II. And that's basically the supporting land units that the French and the British, they're almost encircled in France. Now, the British, they were going to be able to escape through Dunkirk, and as we know, they did. And the German expeditionary force, basically, they were going to originally sweep in, block that, and then basically they'd have to completely encircled, death blow, all dealt with. That's it. But essentially, Goering makes an absolutely fatal mistake here. He hugely overestimates his ability, and he says that the Luftwaffe can finish off the job. You don't need an army on the ground. And, you know, we kind of knew from the artillery use of World War I, and Goering should have known this. He really should have known that this wasn't possible, but he didn't. And he persuaded the higher-ups that he could use his Luftwaffe, and that they wouldn't need to use the troops, and that he could take care of the British. But he couldn't, and he just didn't manage to crush them. A huge fleet of ships comes across the channel, rescues the British troops. If you haven't seen the movie Dunkirk, well worth a watch. I felt it was a bit overhyped, but very dramatic, quite enjoyable. Definitely not one to miss. Definitely not in the cinemas anymore. It was quite something on the big screen. Anyway, now, despite this pretty major catastrophe, it wasn't looking all bad for the Germans. France had signed an armistice on the 22nd of June, 1940. The Germans maybe thought that Britain would surrender afterwards, but they continued on to fight. You know that. Now, Goering is still full of boasts at this point. He basically says that, the Luftwaffe, it will make short work of the British RAF. They don't stand a chance. And just because Goering thinks his planes are superior and just better and there's more of them, but that's not really the case. They were very much matched by the British Spitfire, not just in ability, but also in numbers. The British had absolutely ratcheted this all up, and they had lots of planes going on. And also, the British had been working on technology that the Germans hadn't managed to develop that yet. They had a radar and a ground control system. I didn't know that radar was a thing in World War II. That seems like a very, you know, modern technology, but there you go. Anyway, so this kind of led to the famous loss of the Battle of Britain. Pretty much a major, major defeat for the Nazis. Also, of course, this is just the Western Front. The Eastern Front's also going horribly wrong. Hitler makes the mistake of invading the Soviet Union. The Germans get encircled at Stalingrad. Their only hope of survival here was retreat. Yeah, but it's Hitler. He didn't want to retreat. Goering, he was also like, he kind of supported Hitler in this notion. He was like, don't worry, Adolf, the Luftwaffe will supply them from the air. They'll be fine. We'll get the supplies in that they need. Except this was kind of just one of Goering's boasts. He absolutely couldn't do that. He completely failed at getting that support in. It's kind of a nonsense idea. In history, people are like, he should have known this wasn't possible, but he didn't. And yeah, so this was a turning point for Germany, a major turning point for Germany, but the Stalingrad thing this is, but more of a major point for turning point for Goering. Hitler basically didn't trust him anymore. It screwed up the Western Front, it screwed up the Eastern Front in Hitler's eyes. British were bombing Germany very heavily at this point, and Goering kind of just decided to go get out of the way. He was like, okay, right, I kind of maybe saw the writing on the wall. He's like, I'm done with this. It's not gone well. I'm just going to get out of the way. So he just travels around Europe. He's plundering for art. He's taking lots of drugs. He's going hunting. He's kind of just living this kind of hedonistic lifestyle, maybe enjoying his few days before he knows what's coming. And that comes. Boy, does that come. 30th of April, 1945. Hitler kills himself, and the Reich is just collapsing, basically. Now, unlike a lot of other Nazis, Goering, he doesn't kill himself, and he doesn't flee. He kind of had this bizarre notion. I mean, remember how deluded he is here, but he has this bizarre notion that he didn't really do anything wrong. I'd argue, remember that quote? God, that terrible quote. Every bullet fired from the barrel of a police pistol is my bullet. If you call that murder, then I'm a murderer. Everything has been ordered by me. Sure, Goering did absolutely nothing wrong. I'm sure no one will think you did. So he surrenders in May to the Americans, very shortly after Hitler's killed himself. And he's got one of the biggest art collections in the world, looted from all over Europe. Also, 20,000 painkillers. So yeah, he was real into his drugs. Now, he was expecting to kind of meet Eisenhower, but that did not happen. Instead, as you might expect, he was charged with war crimes. They also imprisoned him. He went on a diet. He got off drugs. Sure, that was very horrible. Good. Now, of all the Nazis who ended up at the Nuremberg trials, Goering was the most senior, and he kind of went back to his original argument, saying that he didn't want war. It was all outside of his control. He urged Hitler not to go to war. And he also said he had no part to do with the Holocaust. He didn't even know it was going on. Maybe he kind of deluded himself into believing all of this. So far, if there's one thing we're taking away from this podcast, is that he was pretty amazing at self-delusion and deluding other people. People kind of thought, though, that it was absurd that he could know nothing of the Holocaust. This was just, like, no, not possible. There was evidence directly linking him to it. He was super high up in the Nazi party. This is not going to happen. Also, we know that he was using slave labor in the factories for the Luftwaffe. Also, we know that the Luftwaffe had done experiments on humans. The Jews, the gypsies, the prisoners of war, they'd all been experimented on by the Luftwaffe directly. So, no, Goering was not an innocent man. Indeed. The court, the Nuremberg trial, they agreed with him. They sentenced him to death. And he was like, let me die like a military man. I want to have a firing squad. And they were like, nah, we're just going to hang you, you common criminal. We're just going to hang you. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. But the fortunate news is he bit down on a cyanide capsule on October the 15th. No one knows where he got it from. And that killed him. So that's the end, pretty much. Very suddenly. We started this episode saying how Goering was this famous hero, that he was a fighter pilot, he took the place of the Red Baron in this elite German military unit, he was very good, he was injured, he returned to duty, he was famous and successful. And then he spent three decades trashing his reputation, being responsible for millions of deaths. And, you know, Goering, at the time of his trial, he still thought that eventually in Germany he would be remembered as a hero. Like, after a few decades, time would pass, wounds would heal, and there'd be statues of him around Germany. But he was horribly wrong. Any crime, all of the crimes he committed, vastly eclipsed the World War I deeds, and basically all we today remember him as, and rightly, is basically an evil Nazi monster who was sentenced to death for his war crimes. And that's where we're going to finish it today. I think next week we'll have someone a little more cheery, but that was Hermann Goering. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please do leave us a review on iTunes if you like. Just go in there, leave a review, how much you want to do, let me know how I'm doing, or drop me an email, simon@biographics.org. Say hello there. If you've got any follow-up for me, if you'd like me to address anything on this podcast, just drop me an email and say hi. Also, you can follow me on Twitter, @SimonWhistler. Very simple, spelt as you'd expect, W-H-I-S-T-L-E-R. And as always, I'll see you next time for another brand new episode.